This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
You're tuned to Britain's grooviest radio show, Top of the Pops. And here come those four lads from North London called The Kinks. The song you've heard before, as it's the one that Kink Ray Davies wrote specially for Dave Berry. And it's called The Strange Effect.
That broadcast recording is included in a Kinks 5-CD box set, collecting the band's recordings from 1964 to 71. It includes their hits like You Really Got Me, All Day and All of the Night, Tired of Waiting for You, Who'll Be the Next in Line, A Well-Respected Man, Dedicated Follower of Fashion, Sunny Afternoon, Lola, and I'm Not Like Everybody Else, which has recently been used in an Acura commercial. The box also includes lesser-known songs as well as outtakes, demos, and remixes. It's a reminder of how great the Kinks were. My guest Ray Davies is the group's lead singer and songwriter, who has also recorded solo albums. His brother Dave is the band's lead guitarist. The Kinks first came to the U.S. in 1965 and were considered part of the British invasion. They're now seen as one of the forerunners of punk rock, although the Kinks had too many sounds and styles to comfortably fit in any one category. They drew on rock and roll, folk, blues, British music hall, and theater music. Let's start with their first hit. From 1964, this is You Really Got Me. Ray Davies, welcome back to Fresh Air. It's great to have you on the show. And as I was telling you before we started, I've been a Kinks fan like since I was 12, but I've never sat down and listened to album after album after album the way I did with this new 5-CD anthology. And what an extraordinary volume of work. And that only takes us to like 1971, the new album. So, wow, is all I can say. So let me ask you about You Really Got Me. Is that how you heard the song in your mind when you wrote it?
Well, You Really Got Me is a strange one because I went to art school. I was doing a 5-year degree course as a painter, a sculptor, and filmmaker. And music was my hobby, but at college we had lots of great bands playing, and it was early days of R&B in Great Britain. I wanted to be a sideman, basically, just play along with other people because I hadn't really written songs. I was more interested in painting. But I played in a few bands. The great Lowell Coxhill, who not many people in America know, but he was kind of a legendary mentor and inspiration for a load of musicians in the UK. Lowell was an improvisational jazz guy, and I was an upstart R&B player. And we sat down jamming one night. It was to a song called Do-Do-Ron-Ron by the Crystals. But Lowell was improvising in the most incredible jazz style. And he looked at me and he said, you know, you should do this R&B music and write your own songs, because he felt that I could write riffs. And I went home and I was trying to write country blues. I was very influenced by a lot of American music. And it's a mixture of a Gregorian chant, because I sang in the choir at school. And if you think of it as, girl, you really got me going. So it's that to a big Bill Brunsey phrase, you know, which is basically G7. So it evolves through a mixture of blues and my sort of English quirky subliminal influence of being in a choir doing Gregorian chant, which definitely comes through if you really think about it.
Wow, I never would have thought that You Really Got Me Going was inspired by Gregorian chant. That never, ever would have occurred to me.
I was 16, 17 at the time, and I was, you know, experimented at age, and I kind of, then the riff came to me, and I played it as a sort of a country riff to begin with, and I thought it'd be good just to have power chords. I also then went to the piano to write the rest of the song, and the piano changed the dynamic a little bit.
But there's something so raw about the track. A lot of people see it as the kind of predecessor of punk. What did you hear? Go ahead.
Well, that came about because we, at home, we had an old record player that the family played records on. My brother Dave and I played records so loud it made the speakers distort, and we thought it'd be a nice idea to make the guitar sound that distorted. And we cranked up the amplifier, and I stuck a knitting needle in it, and I think legend has it that Dave tried it with a razor blade, although I wasn't present. But eventually we used that as a distorted little preamp and plugged it into a regular amp that gave it what is very distinctive sound on the record.
What did you want for yourself back then in 1964? Did you want a life in music? You saw yourself as an art student, not necessarily as a musician.
Yeah, well, when you're 16, 17 years old, you're not sure what you want. I still don't know what I am, what I want. Again, it was probably the third or fourth song I'd ever written. I wrote a couple of bad pop songs. The very first song I wrote was a country and western song. It was more for someone like Roy Rogers, you know.
Oh, I love
Gene Autry.
Gene Autry. I love Gene Autry.
He's great.
Yeah, he's great. I know. Oh, you wouldn't sing a few bars of that, would you?
I can't remember it. It's something to do with Rocky Skies Above and the worst rhyming couplet ever, Just Made for Love. I never thought. It wasn't until You Really Got Me became a number one record in most of Europe that people actually thought I knew what I was doing. And that's quite scary because, like I said, I wanted to be an artist, so I had to learn how to write songs. I think if I'd been an accomplished songwriter, I wouldn't have written You Really Got Me. There's something naive about it and basic about it. People forget the important thing in it is the key shift halfway through.
Right.
A normal blues goes through the triad of G, C to D to C to G. But I took it up to A on the piano, which is quite revolutionary. Took it up one step. But if I had really thought and analysed it, I probably wouldn't have done that. So it's a very naive track that by just persistence and belief and pig-headedness got me sort of a record that's went to number one.
My guest is Ray Davies, the lead singer and songwriter of The Kinks. Let's hear another early track from the new box set, The Kinks, the Anthology, 1964 to 71. This is Stop Your Sobbin', recorded in 1964. This was later covered by The Pretenders.
It is time for you to stop all of your sobbing. This is time for you to stop all of your sobbing. Mm-hmm. There's one thing you gotta do to make me still want you. Gotta stop sobbing now. Yeah. Stop it, stop it. You gotta stop sobbing now. It is time.
That's The Kinks, recorded in 1964, and it's called Stop Your Sobbing. And it reminds me a little of the Beatles in the harmonies, but it heads into a more Kink, you know, it's like a very Kinks record, but with Beatles-ish harmonies. Do you think of the Beatles as having influenced the song?
I think the distinctive thing about the later Kinks music is that Dave, my brother, had a very high voice, and he could sing an octave above me, which gave it quite unique. But you're talking about simple two or three-part harmonies. You don't have to come from Liverpool to know how to do that. it's not a typical Kink-sounding harmony part, but it's it has a melodic feel to it. But listening to the rhythm track, it was very rooted in what we thought was American soul music from the South, the chink chink.
So
it was nice hearing it and listening to the reverb on the vocal. It's quite.
It's really a great track.
It's a great track.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about coming to America to tour. You were still in your teens?
Yeah, in my final year as a teen.
Okay. And so what was it like to come to America and be seen as part of this, like, British invasion? Like, suddenly you were British as opposed to just British. Do you know what I mean? It was, like, a big deal to be British at that time in America.
I think listening to Stop Your Sobbing, if it had been, say, the Beatles or another Merseybeat band, it would be more well-produced, more refined. And there was a raw edge to the Kinks, I think. You know, you're talking America, 65, still quite conservative in most places. And I think the Kinks were just the thin end of the wedge, you know, just couldn't really... We didn't have a publicity machine that could deal with our idiosyncratic ways. And my brother was 17 and did what 17-year-old people do. And I was kind of... I just got married. My first daughter had been born... I think 2 weeks before I went on tour, our management were in dispute. Royalties were frozen because of a dispute with the publishing company. And as a result, royalties were frozen. So it was not a great time to embark on this immense continent, which is an inspiration for lots of my music. In fact, the reason I became a musician.
Right.
And it ended up in a union ban. I think I refer to it a mixture of bad management, bad luck, and bad behaviour. Resulted in a union ban. We couldn't work in America for nearly 4 years.
Wow. So you were married by the time you came to America. I remember, you know, when John Lennon was married to Cynthia early in the life of the Beatles, he was told not to let on. And she had a kind of like trail in back of the band because, you know, the Beatles management was afraid that girls wouldn't see John as this, like, romantic object of fantasy if they knew he was married. Did anybody tell you to hide the fact that you were married and a father?
No, because we were the Kinks. You know, we didn't really... Again, I said our publicity machine was not well-oiled like the Beatles. We didn't have any, you know, agenda. We were what we were. You know, the Beatles to us were establishment figures and... Well, very well respected for their songwriting and records, and they broke the mold of pop music from the UK. But we didn't really care about that, and that's the thing about the Kinks. I think the reason we endured when we came back from the 3.5-year ban, we just played clubs. Our last gig in America, I think, before the ban was Hollywood Bowl and a big festival in Seattle, playing in front of like 20,000 people. When we came back, we played clubs that held 200. But it was just our intrepid desire and pig-headedness that kept us going. And by this time, I'd been writing songs for 2 or 3 years, and I was actually beginning to like it. So I had a lot I wanted to write about.
What's some of the music that you grew up with? You had, what, 8 siblings? I think your father played banjo. Do I have that right?
Yeah. I had 6 sisters, and much older than I. They're the youngest to nearest in age to me is Gwen, and Gwen is, I think, 7 years older than I am. So there's a generation gap almost between my brother and our sisters. And they, of course, we were exposed to music of their era, big band music, a lot of jazz, a lot of 50s, bebop, and early rock and roll that we wouldn't have been had found accessible to us without them. And they were incredible dancers. They used to go dancing. The dance hall was called the Palais. And I wrote a musical about 7 years ago called Come Dancing about my sisters. And it was we actually made a record called Come Dancing as well. So they're very, very big influence. And we used to watch them dance with their boyfriends, look through the keyhole and when we shouldn't be looking. They're a vital part of our musical education. Dad was into Dixieland. In many respects, he was sort of an early blues man in many ways. He moved brilliantly. the dance hall style of dancing, as you probably know or heard about, was very rigid and formulaic. But Dad's dancing was very loose, almost like it was from Louisiana or somewhere. And so it was an oddball family. And we had always had a sing-song every weekend. My parents encouraged the girls to bring back their boyfriends and play records and play the piano. All my sisters played the piano. We had piano lessons.
So when you started recording, you didn't think of yourself as a songwriter or necessarily as a singer. Did you think of yourself as having a good voice?
No. I've got probably one of the most unorganized voices imaginable.
What does unorganized mean?
I'm not conventional in the studio. I didn't think I was a singer. I always thought my brother was a singer because he had a good look. And that's Dave, had a good look, and he could reach the notes and sing the Gene Vincent parts on Bebopalula and the Eddie Cochran parts. But there was an energy in Eddie Cochran's playing and singing that Dave really caught well. But I was just sort of the guy that played guitar. And it wasn't until we made our first recording sessions that people said, I think they felt like I could enunciate better. So I don't know. I fell into singing by accident.
I want to play another track. This is another famous Kinks track and dedicated follower of fashion. And I want to play this because it has, you know, unlike You Really Got Me and some of the early hits, which are very proto-punk, this is more kind of like dance hall with like a two-quarter beat, like an oompa kind of beat to it. And I'd like you to talk about the musical influences behind the song and also what you were thinking about when you wrote the lyric.
After You Really Got Me, people thought I knew what I was doing, and I pretended to know what I was doing, and I made All Down All the Night and all other rock songs. At art school, I used to draw characters on the street, cartoons and illustrations of people, and I think I took character studies over into my music. The actual song dedicated Follower of Fashion itself was inspired, well, as a result of an argument with a fashion designer who came to my house. You know, because I got married when I was 20, I think, I was at home, suburbanite, while my brother and the rest of the band went to London and played around in clubs. And this fashion designer accused me of wearing flares when they were not.
You mean like bell-bottoms?
Yeah, like mega Sonny and Cher type flares.
Right, okay.
Mega flares.
Okay.
And it was a fashion dispute, and he accused me of being dull because I didn't go into the high society of Carnaby Street and particularly the King's Road anymore. And it was after an argument about style, really. In a sense, it was a protest song. And the vocal is very affected, I think, because the key we recorded in, you know, we had no opportunity to re-record stuff because we didn't have the budget. So the key was not my range. So I formed a character for the song. I became the character. And that's why it's extreme enunciation. They seek him here, they seek him there. But basically it's a good rock track. It just, and there is an umpah feel, you're right. Maybe it's the Lithuanian influence, I don't know.
Lithuanian influence?
My first wife was Lithuanian refugee, which is not different from Polish music and umpah music. But also, the umpah feel is very British, very English. At school, I did English country dancing, and they're all traditional songs and dance around the maypole and all that stuff. And I think there's an element of English culture in the song. It has an umpah feel to it, which is pure folk, really.
Ray Davies will be back in the second half of the show. Let's hear the song we've been talking about, Dedicated Follower of Fashion, but we'll hear an outtake from a recording session in 1966. It's included in the new Kinks 5-CD box set that will come out in December. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Okay, man. Follower of Fashion, one.
Don't forget, fellas, goes that... Why don't you wait till we start second verse? Down, down, bam. Yeah, try that. Let's try that anyway. One, two, three, four.
They seek him here, they seek him there. His clothes are loud, but never square. It will make or break him, so he's got to buy the best, 'cause he's a dedicated follower of fashion. And when he does his little round, round the blue.
Actually, it started out slower than you have been.
Yeah, I think it sounds better a bit slower.
Well, it was swinging before, man.
Was it? All right. This time in the morning. One, two, one, two, three, four.
I want to play another track that's included on this, and it's a demo called I Go to Sleep. It's from 1965, and it's Ray Davies singing and at the piano. It's a demo.
When I look up from my pillow, I dream you are there. Imagine that you're there with me. I go to sleep, sleep, and imagine that you're there with me. I look around me and feel you are ever so close to me.
That was Ray Davies singing in at the piano, a song that he wrote called I Go to Sleep. It was recorded in 1965, and it's featured on the new Kinks Anthology, which is a 5-album collection. That's really a terrific song and a really interesting demo, and I think the piano playing is really interesting on it, too. So would you tell us a little bit about writing that song, which, again, is something that doesn't sound like what the Kinks were best known for in the 60s.
Yes, that song is exploration, learning how to do it. The piano playing is very basic. You know, most of the great song. I was a big friend of a man called Mort Schumann, who wrote with Doc Pomus lots of hits for the Drifters. And he said a lot of great writers aren't good piano players, which helps the writing. If you're too virtuoso, you make the song too overwhelmingly complex. So that's the joy of listening to demos. I wish I've got a whole slew of demos in various boxes. It shows the process, the unexplored possibilities, and it allows the listeners to imagine what could be better or how it can be implemented. But it shows the process. It shows a writer trying to explore new territory in this wonderful art form that's been not thrust upon me but put in my direction. And it's not a love song. I don't think it mentions love in it. That was another thing with the Kinks. Think back to the early songs, and even past You Really Got Me, All Day and All the Night. The word love never occurs.
But it's about obsession with a girl. I mean, they both are.
They are, yes. But I Go to Sleep is about someone on a journey and missing somebody. And sleep has always been a big issue in my life because I'm a very bad sleeper, even as I was a baby. Because I was born just post-war, and there were still what they called doodle bugs being sent from Germany to bomb England. So it was the tail end of the Second World War, 1945. So apparently I was a really bad sleeper, and so sleep is a constant recurring theme in my music.
Do you have insomnia?
Insomnia, yes. I don't know what causes it. I think, well, I won't bore the audience with all my insomnia problems, but it's an issue I have since childhood. I really admire and am jealous of people who just fall asleep, and that's a real talent or a
definitely
blessing
it's a gift. Yeah, definitely a gift.
Yeah.
So another track I want to play that's included on the new anthology, and it's Dead End Street. And this is a good example of just kind of like working class reality songs about, you know, like this song is about people in a dead end street, about people who have no chance to emigrate and who are stuck. Does this relate to the neighborhood you grew up in at all?
Dead End Street came about. It had this massive hit called Sunny Afternoon. And everyone said, oh, it's great. England just won the World Cup, World Soccer Cup. At the same time, Sunny Afternoon was a hit. And everything seemed centered. But I didn't feel that. I'm not morbid, but I'm a realist to the extreme sometimes. It was inspired by a leak in a pipe I had. Winter was coming on. And I realised all was not good in swinging London. It was a time when we devalued our currency. We had terrible immigration issues and culture was changing in England because England went through a tremendous, like so many places did after the Second World War, of austerity. And the 60s were meant to be the revival, the joy. But I was not of that belief. I think the 60s were in many respects a diversion, swinging London and all that. So I wanted to write a follow-up to Sunny Afternoon, which was a celebration, really, of the time. And Dead End Street, I think it came out in 67 or 66. It was almost written like a Dixieland stomp about hard times and depression, financial depression. And all is not well, but we are strictly second class and we don't understand. Because in the 60s, and the revolution that occurred with working class culture prior to that, everyone seemed to be classless. But for some reason, I instinctively knew, that it was not, strictly speaking, that way. So how do you make a pop song out of that? We managed to do it. We had an up chorus and some interesting chord changes. And I think it exemplified a period in England where people were thinking, hang on a minute, what's really happening here?
So this is Dead End Street, 1966, The Kinks, and it's included on the new 5-volume Kinks anthology. Kinks, recorded in 1966, Dead End Street. It's included on the new anthology, The Kinks, the anthology, 1964 to 1971. It's a 5-album set. And my guest is Ray Davies, the lead songwriter and singer of The Kinks, who, of course, also records solo albums. So I have to say that really sounds great, and it sounds really raw, too. I love how all the backup vocals are really just, like, shouting in the background.
The interesting thing about the record, though, is that the ending needed I wanted something other than a guitar solo. I wanted to be in the tradition of trad jazz. And we went, there was a pub, it was recorded at Pye Studios, which is in London, the centre of London. We went to the local pub and saw a musician who'd just been on a session who played trombone, and we dragged him in, just asked him to come and sit and play on it. We just grabbed him from a bar, put the solo on the end, and we mixed the record that night. So it's all chance. I love things like that when they happen.
You were hospitalized as a child and ended up having to have an emergency tracheotomy when you were 7, I think it was. Is that right?
No, let's back up a bit.
Yes, let's.
I had an accident when I fell off a wall, like I was trying to fly, but I didn't realize the wall was like 12 feet high, and I fell and broke my jaw and busted my nose and lost lots of teeth when I was about five or six. And I had to have restorative operation just to re-engage my bite, and my jaw didn't set properly. So they put me in hospital. I had a tracheotomy because of my breathing, and had a near-death experience because of a bad tracheotomy.
What do you remember from the near-death experience?
Oh, do you really need to know that?
I don't need to know that, but if you wanted to share it, I'd be interested in knowing it.
I think it's. I seem to remember lots of colors. It's partially because I was suffocating and I was sinking down, and had there were two horses with no flesh, just muscle and bone, colliding. I remember lots of colors as they merged into one another. That's the only way I can describe it. Then I felt terrible pressure on my chest, and the doctor was banging my chest. So I think everybody experiences these things in different ways. That was my recollection of what happened to me. I was very lucky. And ironically, the hospital was called St. Thomas's, and it was right by Waterloo Bridge. And Waterloo has played a very important part in my life. It's a district in London where they have a big train station. It's in the middle of London, near the Houses of Parliament. It's a beautiful spot. You know, when you romanticise it, it's a wonderful place to be, seeing people going in different directions. Then I had the experience in the hospital when I was being operated on. And then I wrote a song years later called Waterloo Sunset. I think most people have this in their lives. To me, it's a blessed spot. You know, a moment that is a truthful spot where I can get centered. And it's by the River Thames. It's near Waterloo.
So in the song, the character is basically gazing out the window, looking at other people, looking at the sunset. Was that inspired by when you were in the hospital and you had to look out the window and you couldn't go out?
Well, that's the way I think a lot of writers work, particularly me as a songwriter. The experience I had at the hospital was probably almost 10 years before I wrote Waterloo Sunset. But I remember the moment of looking out. They wheeled me to the window with my stuff I was plugged into and stood me on the balcony. It's a beautiful balcony at the hospital, looks over the river. And probably I drew on that experience and put it in the song Waterloo Sunset, which is about a man watching two people, a young couple, walking across the bridge to their future. And the couple, to me, represented my sisters, who amazingly enjoyed their life. They lived through the Second World War. They remembered the blackouts and the bombs and having to hide in shelters in the back garden, going in the subway when there were bombing raids in London. But yet they loved it, and they wouldn't have exchanged that time, amazingly, wouldn't have exchanged that for any other reason. So the two characters in Waterloo Sunset were that generation going to the future. And I was a person observing from this window. And probably I thought of that experience years earlier when I stood at the window in the hospital. But that's the way I think a lot of writers work. You know, I've got a saying, my subconscious is smarter than I am. I've drawn many emotions and memories from my past and the present. And sometimes, as in Waterloo Sunset, it's about the future. So all elements are there. And that's, I think, the magical thing you can do with song.
Well, let's hear Waterloo Sunset. This is the Kinks, and this track is included on the new Kinks anthology.
I'm in paradise.
was Waterloo Sunset, written by my guest, Ray Davies, who also sings lead on that. It's included on the new Kinks anthology, which covers the years 1964 to 1971. You know, we were talking about how you were in the hospital when you were, how old, seven?
No, I had the accident when I was six, between six and seven. Okay. They did the operation when I was 13, 14.
Oh, I see.
It's a repair job.
So that year that you had the accident and you were hospitalized, I think that was the same year that one of your older sisters died of a heart condition.
She died on my 13th birthday, so it's around that time. Yeah.
Did that whole, you know, confluence of things, you being really sick and nearly dying and then your sister actually dying, make you feel very vulnerable or make you afraid of or at least reflective about death?
When you're 13 years old, it's my birthday, she gave me my first guitar on my birthday. As a present, we played. It was quite a surreal scene, almost. It was a sunny day. I was born Midsummer Day, so 21st of June. And she was told she had severe heart problems, but she loved to dance. And the doctors told her if she walked down the road, she'd probably have a heart attack. So she bought me this not very expensive Spanish guitar. Gave it to me on my birthday, and we played a few songs. She played a song on the piano, and I tried to play with her, and she said she was going out now. And I watched my sister go out. It was a sunny afternoon, and she walked down the road, and my mother stood at the gate, and that was it. And the next morning we got a call from the police that she had died dancing in a ballroom in London in the arms of a stranger. And they came to break the news to my parents. So it was, well, the birthday was forgotten, but that's irrelevant. But it was the whole sequence of events, her coming back from Canada where she'd emigrated to die, really. And again, being a source of inspiration, she was an artist herself, and seeing her go that way and the impact it had on the family. So I think anyone, teenager, experiences that situation has emotions attached to it. But I didn't realise what a watershed it was. She gave me my first guitar, which was quite a great parting gift. And on the piano she played the day she died, I wrote most of my early hits in that same room. It's the front room. The front room is where we had the parties. It's where the girls brought their boyfriends home and their husbands. It's where I was born in that room. My brother was born in that room. Because from our generation, people were born at home more. And my sister's parting gift was given to me in that room. So it's all very symbolic,
right.
Which I think is quite beautiful, really.
So a Kink song that a lot of people have been hearing lately is I'm Not Like Everybody Else, because it's used on an Acura commercial, on a TV commercial. And I'm wondering,
really?
Oh, you don't know?
I had no idea. Well, that's great. If it, you know, the great thing about it, if it brings music to a new audience, it's fine. I love that song, and I still do it in my show.
Oh, I love that song too. And you wrote
I'm proud to have written. Sometimes I don't write the songs write me.
Mm-hmm.
But it was written, curiously enough, it was written for my brother to sing. And it's a song about being angry, and I cast the song for him. I do that sometimes. Now, I've said this before, this analogy. Mick Jagger, to his credit, is always, you know what you're getting, he's Jumping Jack Flash all the time, and he's a wonderful character. With me and my impact it has on the Kinks, I'm a different character sometimes when I sing songs. The man who sings All Day and All the Night, is it really the person who sings Waterloo Sunset and Days? So, but with I'm Not Like Everybody Else, I noticed a rebellious streak in my brother that was beyond my own, let's put it politely. And I wrote a song about anger for him to sing. And he sings, I think, on the original Kinks recording.
So here's I'm Not Like Everybody Else, recorded in 1966. It's from the soon-to-be-released box set, The Kinks, the anthology, 1964 to 1971.
Take it all lying down, 'cause once I get started I go to town. 'Cause I'm not like everybody else, 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 and I don't.
That's The Kinks, recorded in 1966 from the new Kinks box set. My guest is the band's lead singer and songwriter, Ray Davies. I want to play one more recording, and this is not something you would have expected from the guy who wrote All Day and All of the Night. Like you say, you have so many different personalities in your songs and so many different styles. This is almost Kurt Weill-ish. It sounds like theater music, and it's from an album that's not included on the new anthology. It's an album called Muswell Hillbillies, and the song is called Alcohol, and there's horns and an accordion, I think, is on this too. Would you talk just a little bit about this song? It's really terrific.
Well, as I said in this interview earlier, my father was influenced by Dixieland and the music hall. And I think before he died, when I was a child, he took me to see one of the last music halls. And it instilled some sort of understanding of the culture he came from. Alcohol, though, was written in the tradition of trad jazz, Dixieland jazz, and we had a horn section at the time. Here's a story about a sinner who used to be a winner. I wanted it to be also. It's almost like a religious anthem, you know, the perils of drink. You know, get behind me, Satan. And it's very apocalyptic in its origins. And the Muswell Hill album itself, there was a lot of that language, sonic language. The greatest compliment I ever had is years after Alcohol came out, we toured in America and we played New Orleans. And our trombone player said, you won't believe this. I just came from a club and they were playing Alcohol. And to me, that was the ultimate accolade. Hearing the music that inspired me to write the song in England a few years before, finally performed in New Orleans by a trad bar band. Life is wonderful when that happens.
Thank you so much for doing this interview. It's really been a pleasure to talk with you and to listen to so many of your recordings, which are so terrific. Thank you again.
Thank you, Terry.
Ray Davies is the lead singer and songwriter of The Kinks, the new 5-CD collection, The Kinks, the anthology, 1964-71, will be released in December.
Here's a story about a sinner. Used to be a winner who enjoyed a life of prominence and position, but the pressures of the office and his social ad engagements and his selfish wife's fanatical ambition, he turned into the booze and he got mixed up with a floozy, and she led him to a life of indecision. The floozy made him spend his dough. She left him lying on Skid Row, a drunken lag at some Salvation Army mission. It's such a shame.
In the spirit of Thanksgiving, we want to thank you for listening to our show. And you know how I say thank you at the end of every interview, and then the guest usually thanks me back? We've put together a short collection of some of the most surprising, by which I think I mean awkward or funny, end of interview thank yous. You can hear it on SoundCloud at soundcloud.com/freshair. All of us at Fresh Air wish you a happy Thanksgiving. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. I'm Terry Gross.